Greetings, and welcome to the CMCS Allstate Medicaid and CHIP call webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. Afterwards, we will conduct a question-and-answer session. If you have a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone at any time during the presentation. At that time, your line will be briefly accessed from the conference to obtain information. You may also submit a written question using the chat feature located on the bottom left of your screen. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press star 0. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Tuesday, February 9th, 2021. I would now like to turn the conference over to Jackie Glaze. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome everyone to today's Allstate call and webinar. I will now turn to Judith Cash, our Acting Deputy Center Director, and she will share highlights for today's discussion. Judith?
Thanks, Jackie, and welcome everyone to today's call. Thanks so much for joining us. First up today, we'll be joined by a special guest from CMS's Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight. We know that as CSIO, and that's Alex Bates. Alex and Suzette Sang from our very own Children and Adult Health Programs Group will discuss the implications of a new federally facilitated exchange special enrollment period for Medicaid and CHIP. That special enrollment period was authorized in an executive order issued by the President last month and is set to begin on February the 15th. After Alex and Suzette's presentation, we'll certainly take some time for your questions on that special enrollment period. And then Kim Proctor from our Data and Systems Group will present new preliminary Medicaid and CHIP COVID-19 data snapshot that was released on January the 15th. This snapshot includes data from the beginning of the public health emergency through the end of July 2020 and provides a variety of information on COVID-19-related utilization by beneficiaries, including data on treatment and outcomes, service use among Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries who are 18 or under, services delivered via telehealth during the public health emergency, and services for mental health and substance use disorder during the public health emergency. Again, after Kim's presentation, we'll open the line for more questions, including any general questions you might have. I also want to note that we are using a webinar for both of today's presentations, so if you're not already logged into the webinar platform, I suggest that you do that now. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alex and Suzette to start their presentation. Alex?
Hey, thank you. So I'll give just a quick highlight of what we'll cover here. So we'll provide an overview of the 2021 special enrollment period, and Suzette will discuss the key implications there for Medicaid and CHIP, along with some reminders on AT processing and considerations for planning ahead. So with that, we can move into the 2021 SEP overview. In accordance with the executive order issued on January 28th by President Biden, CMS determined that the COVID-19 emergency presents exceptional circumstances for consumers in accessing health insurance. And because of these exceptional circumstances, CMS will provide a special enrollment period to give individuals and families an opportunity to apply and enroll in coverage. So from February 15th through May 15th, the SEP will be available to marketplace-eligible consumers submitting new applications or updating existing applications in the 36 states that use the healthcare.gov platform. These consumers can access the SEP a few different ways, such as by going directly to healthcare.gov, by calling the marketplace call center, or through direct enrollment channels. And moving on to the next slide, CMS will conduct an outreach campaign using a mix of paid advertising, such as broadcast and digital media, and it will include direct outreach to consumers as well, all aimed at building awareness and encouraging the uninsured as well as those exploring coverage options on healthcare.gov to continue the process and enroll in coverage. And with that, I'll hand it over to Suzette.
Thanks so much, Alex, and thank you for that important information. So now we'd like to focus on the key implications for Medicaid and CHIP agencies regarding this special enrollment period. So the SDP is likely to cause an increase in application volume for both state-submitted applications and account transfers. Due to the outreach efforts that Alex just described, states may experience a potential increase in applicant and beneficiary inquiries at state call and state call center volumes. Part of this call volume increase may be as a result of consumer confusion about the need to take any action as a result of the SEP. This may be particularly the case for beneficiaries who are continuously enrolled in Medicaid under the FFCRA continuous enrollment requirement. And we'll touch upon that a little more in this presentation. So we will start with some general reminders and an overview of the account transfer process. And some reminders on how to handle specific scenarios during this, always, and especially during this special enrollment period. So states who are served by the federally facilitated exchange will continue to receive outbound account transfers as they do throughout the year. And as a reminder, an outbound, when we refer to an outbound account transfer, it is a transfer from the federally facilitated exchange to the state. So states will continue to receive these, and the different types of account transfers states receive are in the assessment or and determination states receive account transfers for eligibility for matter-based Medicaid and CHIP. States elect whether they are an assessment or a determination state. All states receive non-MAGI referrals for individuals who answer yes to specific screening questions that indicate they may be eligible on a basis other than MAGI, for example, disability. All states also receive account transfers for inconsistencies and PENs for individuals who attest to MAGI income and other factors that would make them potentially eligible for Medicaid or CHIP, but for whom the FFE cannot verify eligibility. And as a reminder, an inconsistency refers to a citizenship or immigration inconsistency, and PENs refer to income and residency inconsistencies. And again, both assessment and determination states receive account transfers and make the final determination for those inconsistencies and PENs. States also receive full determination requests. In assessment states, if the FFE assesses an individual as ineligible, applicants may request a full determination from the state agency. The full determination request is sent to the state for a final MAGI-based determination and also for a non-MAGI determination. In determination states, as the FFE has already made the final determination for MAGI-based coverage, a full determination request sent to a determination state are only sent for completion of a determination for non-MAGI-based coverage. The next couple of slides will give an overview of state responsibilities, first in an assessment state and then in determination states. So in an assessment state, the FFE transfers the account to individuals assessed as potentially eligible to the state agency for a final determination. As we discussed in the slide before, the FFE also transfers accounts for individuals whose information was not verified by the FFE, the individuals who have a PEN or an inconsistency, and for those not assessed as eligible but who have requested that their accounts be transferred to the state agency for a full Medicaid CHIP determination. And again, in an assessment state, that is both for a MAGI and non-MAGI-based coverage. So once the state receives that account transfer, the state's responsibilities are as follows. The first step in the process is to notify the FFE of receipt of the electronic account, and this is called technically an acknowledgement that is sent from the state to the FFE, again, acknowledging receipt of the electronic account. States should not request information from the applicant if it's already included in the electronic account, and the state should accept findings related to specific eligibility criteria made by the FFE without further verification. Based on the information sent in the account transfer, the state should promptly determine eligibility for MAGI-based coverage and non-MAGI-based coverage, if appropriate, without requiring a new application. The state should notify the applicant of the eligibility determination and enroll if eligible. The state should then notify the FSC of the final determination of the individual's eligibility or ineligibility, and this is called an outbound response.
So this is Jessica Stevens jumping in because it seems like Suzette was knocked off of the webinar. So I'm going to pick up from where she left off. And Okay. I'll let Suzette jump back in. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Suzette.
I can advance. Thank you. Okay. So picking up at the process, the state responsibilities for determination state. So in the determination state, the FSE is making the final determination for MAGI-based to Medicaid. So the FSE transfers the electronic account for individuals who have been determined eligible for MAGI-based Medicaid through the hub to the state agency, and the state accepts that determination as final. Similarly to assessment states, the FSE also transfers accounts for individuals whose information was not verified by the FSE and for those not determined as eligible but who have requested that their accounts be transferred to the state agency for a full Medicaid CHIP determination on a non-MAGI basis. State agency responsibilities, again, the state notifies the FSE of receipt of the electronic account after the send-in acknowledgement. The state promptly enrolls individuals in Medicaid and CHIP and sends notice as appropriate. For individuals who have a pending inconsistency, the state collects additional information to resolve inconsistencies and pens and completes a final determination as needed. And they notify the applicant of the eligibility determination and enroll if eligible. Determination states also determine eligibility on a non-MAGI basis if appropriate and send notice and legal coverage if they find the individual eligible. And they notify the FSE of the final determination of an individual's eligibility or ineligibility. Again, an outbound response. So the next slide is a reminder to states on processing real-time outbound account transfers. Since the fall of 2019, the FSE has sent outbound account transfers to states in real-time instead of nightly batches. Because the account transfers are sent in real-time, multiple versions of an application may be sent to the state via an outbound account transfer if an applicant returns to the FSE to update their application in the same day. So we wanted to highlight the guidance we provided to states on these same-day versions of an application. States need only process the last version of an application submitted in a given day, and states may identify the last version of an application in a day by using the date timestamp information provided in the account transfer payload. States may also receive additional versions of an application in subsequent days after the initial submission date. States should process, fully process those account transfers as they may contain information that constitutes a change in circumstance that may affect eligibility and must be addressed consistent with our regulations at 42 CFR 435.916 and 457.342. Processing account transfers for beneficiaries who are already enrolled in Medicaid and CHIP. It is possible that existing Medicaid beneficiaries may end up applying at the Federal Facilitated Exchange during this 2021 SEP, especially if they are unsure of their current enrollment status. This may be more likely in states who are sending notices to ineligible individuals informing them that they are ineligible but continue to be enrolled in Medicaid under the FSCRA. If these individuals are assessed or determined eligible for Medicaid or CHIP, the FSC will transfer these accounts for states to process. states will need to deduplicate applications sent via the account closure process to identify individuals that are known to the state, either as a current enrollee or applicant. And this is states follow this process now, but wanted to stress the importance of the deduplication of these accounts that may the state may receive. States need to process any updated information in the more recent account transfer as a change in the beneficiary system. Similarly, individuals may, an existing Medicaid HIP beneficiary may end up applying for coverage at the FFE during the 2021 SEP. It is possible that he or she could be determined by the FFE as eligible for coverage in a QHP with APTC. This may result in dual enrollment in Medicaid CHIP and QHP APTC coverage for the individual. Individuals determined or assessed ineligible for Medicaid or CHIP by an exchange who enroll in a QHP with APTC will not be liable to pay back APTC according to the IRS guidance, and we've included the link below here to that IRS FAQ. Our last slide is a little forward-thinking in helping states as they begin preparing for the 2021 special enrollment period and the possible increase in applications, both from the FFE and from applications submitted through the state. We wanted to provide some resources that may assist states address increased volume and strategies. This first strategy, plan for increased application and call center volume. We wanted to provide a resource that was part of the Coverage Learning Collaborative, ensuring timely and accurate eligibility determinations. This deck discusses policies and procedures that improve timeliness and may be a helpful resource for states as they plan for possible increased volume due to the 2021 SEP. As states think through the strategies for addressing increased volume, states may also want to consider temporary policy or operational changes to facilitate timely determinations of eligibility, including updating the state verification plan and policies, and also temporarily accepting FSE assessments as determinations. So if a state is currently an assessment state, they may accept the assessment as a determination for a time-limited period without needing to submit a state plan amendment. If the state would like to make a more permanent change, they would need to submit a state plan amendment. And this is more fully described in our disaster toolkit. States will also want to closely monitor systems regularly to identify issues in sending and receiving account transfers. And states should report planned system outages to MACS.gov and contact the SSIO IT project manager for assistance if needed. And I think we will take questions.
Thank you, Suzette, and thank you, Alex. So we're ready to take your questions now on the FFE SEP. So we'll begin by taking your questions through the chat function first, and then we'll follow with taking questions over the phone line. So you can begin submitting your questions through the chat function at this time. While we're waiting to get your questions through the chat function, we'll open up the phone lines to see if you have any questions there. So, operator, can you provide instructions and open up the phone lines at this time?
Thank you. If you'd like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4 on your telephone. You'll hear a 3-tone prompt to acknowledge your request. Your line will then be accessed from the conference to obtain information. If your question has been answered and you would like to withdraw your registration, please press the 1 followed by the 3. Once again, to register for a question over the phone lines, please press the 1 followed by the 4.
Are there any questions?
We have no questions over the phone lines at this time.
Okay, so we'll just proceed with the agenda. Go ahead.
Jackie, it looks like we have one question that came in through the chat box.
Okay.
And it is, where is the process to temporarily accept FSE assessments outlined, and how quickly can the change be made?
Sure. So the process is outlined in the CMS Disaster Toolkit, which is on our Medicaid .gov website. And how quickly can that change be made? If the state is planning to use it again for a time-limited period, they could just that they could let CMS know that you'll be accepting assessments as determinations and start doing that right away.
Okay, so we'll now move on to the next part of the agenda, and then we can certainly come back and take additional questions at the end of the session today. So now we'll transition to Kim Proctor, and she'll provide an overview of the CMCS COVID data snapshot. So Kim, I'll turn it over to you.
Great, thank you so much. And I'm Kim Proctor. I'm a technical director in the Data and Systems Group. And today I'm going to present the recent update that we published on the Medicaid and CHIP COVID-19 summaries. And I want to just start by saying that we're really excited to present this today. We have released a couple of these decks before. So of these four decks, two are updates and two have new content. And so there are over 50 slides in this presentation. There won't be enough time to spend a lot of time on every single slide. So I would definitely encourage you to go explore the publicly released tool through the link in the chat box and also what's available online so you can see all the extra detail that we have here. But we are really excited to release this because it is among the most real time we've ever been able to push data out at CMS on Medicaid and CHIP. That's really exciting, particularly in response to the public health emergency, and it absolutely would not be possible without timely and accurate submissions from states. So I think this is just a great example of that federal-state partnership, and we are very excited to present the results to you today. So to orient us in the product, I think, you know, everyone will have a good sense for the basics of Medicaid and CHIP. The only thing I really want to spend time highlighting here is that this is based on September TAMHSA submissions. Those will include services through August, and we have only presented results through July because of the claims lag or claims runout issues that I'll talk about on the next couple of slides. But basically, we know that it takes time for states to send claims to us, so we want to leave a little bit of a gap there to make sure that when we present results, it's reflecting what's happening as accurately as possible and trying to account for that runout issue whenever possible. So basically, all the results will be focused on the period of March through July of 2020, and we'll compare that to the same time period in 2019. So this is what I was referencing with the claims lag issue. So basically, we know that there's a lag between when a service occurs and when we will see it at CMS. That's going to vary based on the submitting state, the claim type, and the delivery system. So this slide is going to show you the four different claim types: inpatient, long-term care, other services, and pharmacy. And then it's going to break it down by fee-for-service and managed care. And a really basic takeaway here is just that encounter records tend to take longer for CMS to see than fee-for-service records. And claims like outpatient claims are going to come faster than, you know, something that's like a long, complex inpatient claim. So just keep that in mind when you view the results. And for people looking at this publicly online, like stakeholders and other people, this is in a footnote on every single page. It's something that we really try to highlight when we present these results. And we break this down a little bit more here because in some parts of the presentation, there's some information on variation we see across states. There are lots of maps and charts. And so we're trying to show people when they look at this presentation that there's a lot of variation in terms of how fast states actually submit their claims. So some states submit really quickly, some states take longer, and that can really change how you interpret the results. So it's not always possible to know in a really short time frame if the variation you're seeing is the result of real variation or claims run out. That's another reason that we try to build in a little bit of buffer for that lag, but it is an important consideration to keep in mind when you review the results. Okay, so this slide just orients you. If you want to go back and look at this presentation, it's really long, so it'll make it much easier to kind of toggle between the different content areas. So the first area we'll spend a little bit of extra time on because it is a new release, and this is our first release on COVID-19 treatment and outcomes. So throughout the course of 2020, we released information on services to beneficiaries 18 and under, and we released information on telehealth, but we did not actually release anything directly on COVID and the Medicaid and CHIP populations. So we were really excited to put this release out last month. And then here, the main thing to highlight specifically for COVID outcomes and treatment, one of the things that we really try to highlight also in many of our footnotes is that these estimates reflect only services covered by Medicaid and CHIP. A service covered by any other insurance program is not going to be reflected in these results. So if a test, if testing is covered via some other payment, you're not going to see that because we didn't pay for it. This is particularly relevant for dually eligible beneficiaries. So you can see here there are over 12.3 million duals who are enrolled in both Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare is often the primary payer for dually eligible beneficiaries, and that means that we are not going to see claims related to that. So I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind if you are interested in the dual population specifically or just what's happening with Medicare in general. Medicare also releases a variety of COVID-19 data snapshots, which you can also explore through this link. So I think the presentations for Medicare and Medicaid go really well together, and I would also encourage you to explore that. But that is a really important thing to keep in mind as you do this, which is that this is only what is covered by Medicaid and CHIP. So for our first slide here, we basically show that between March and July, there were over 730,000 beneficiaries treated for COVID-19. You can see the map on the left that's going to show you that variation across states and peg it to per 100,000 beneficiaries to just adjust for program size. And then that chart on the right is just going to show you how this is moving over time. So there's just a lot of information on this slide about the number of beneficiaries, the variance across states, and the variance across time. And I think one of the encouraging things is that even though we're conducting analysis in relatively real time, we really do see, for example, increasing cases reflecting what we know is happening from other data sources. And then this slide is showing acute care use. So we're really focusing on hospitalizations. And here we show that there were nearly 80,000 hospitalizations between March and July of last year. And you can see in the chart that we have broken that down apart by ICU stays with a ventilator use, and just general inpatient stays. So you can see a wealth of information about what was happening during those hospitalizations for the beneficiaries. And then same thing on the left, you can see those hospitalizations per 100,000 beneficiaries. And you can see that they appear to be concentrated in a few key states. And then for this slide, we are showing how Medicaid and CHIP enrollment has changed relative to changes in the unemployment rate. And so we can see here that enrollment does continue to steadily increase. So for this presentation, this is an update of a presentation that we have publicly released before. So because we have presented this at this group before, I'll talk about this at a really high level to make sure that we have a lot of time to talk about some of our new content, particularly at the end. So the key thing to focus on here, this is particularly for service utilization for beneficiaries aged 18 and under. We cover over 41.5 million children. We cover many children living in poverty and many children that require special health care services. We have focused this analysis on some key primary preventive and mental health services that children normally receive. The results are very similar to what we have seen before in the sense that we have seen services decline among many key areas that we're monitoring. And we are starting to see services rebound, but there is a lot of variance, not just across states in terms of that rebound, but actually across the different content areas. And that's one of the things that we've been able to see as we continue to monitor this, as some areas appear to be rebounding quickly, more quickly than others. We have seen a drastic increase in service delivery via telehealth, but it is just not enough to offset the decline in services that we see for children, especially for mental health services. Of the services that we are examining in this analysis, it appears that mental health service rates are rebounding the least by the time we get to the end of July for our last period of analysis. And as I mentioned, and I will continue to mention throughout this presentation, there is a ton of state variation. Some states are returning to pre-pandemic levels. Some states appear to be even surpassing pre-pandemic levels. And some states appear to be taking a longer time to rebound in terms of giving care to children. So for the first slide here, we show this data on vaccinations. And so what you can see here is that for that period between March and July of 2020, we have about 1.5 million fewer vaccines, which is about 12%. So that decline really started in April. It does appear to have recovered by June, which is very encouraging. But you know, even with that recovery, we are still missing a significant number of vaccinations. This slide shows some of the state variation. Many states have started to rebound, and some states are, you know, surpassing their pre-pandemic levels, which is very encouraging. So this slide is showing a very similar theme for child screening services. So in this case, the main thing to focus on here is on this bottom right. These charts will all look the same. The headlines will change slightly, but all these numbers will be updated. So you can see the increase or the change in the number of services that are missing compared to the 2019 benchmark. So in this case, we are missing about 3.7 million child screening services, which is almost 30% fewer. And we're seeing the same thing here, very encouraging. Many states have started to rebound, which I think is great, but that we still have many services that have been missed that we would want to close that gap for. And then dental services definitely shows a really significant decline. So I think when we originally made these slides, it was like a 90% decline between March and April. I mean, it was just an astronomical decline. So the results are showing that there was a really substantial decline from March to April, and that it has increased, but it is still very far below prior year rates, and that does translate to a gap of over 9 million missing dental services, which is about 50% fewer. So, you know, this is a really sharp V-shape, but there's still a large gap between those prior year levels of care and the 2020 levels of care. And then we can see that V really reflected in what the states have submitted. So there's a really sharp drop with most states beginning to recover by the time that July has come. And then I mentioned this slide on outpatient mental health services for children. So we saw these services start to decline in March. And of the services that we're seeing, you know, this is really one of the ones that doesn't have as much of a V-shape in the sense that the decline started early in the pandemic and it appears to have really continued. The green line is showing the sharp increase in telehealth that we saw, but it was just not increased enough to offset that decline, particularly given the persistent nature of the decline. And so here you can see that we are missing about 8.4 million mental health services, even when we account for those telehealth visits. So that's a lot of services. It's about 35% fewer services when you compare the same time period in 2020 to 2019. And you can see the same, and this really reflects it. I think this relationship is very consistent when we start to look at states. So here, you know, it's dropped, but it really hasn't recovered in most states. There absolutely is variance, but the general trend is that there's been a decline that has not started to rebound as much. And this is showing that relationship with telehealth, and this will be reflected in the telehealth portion, which is that we saw this explosion of telehealth in April, but that explosion started to taper off by July, even though, particularly for this issue, some of those in-person services haven't really resumed entirely yet. So this is showing that telehealth information in greater detail. You can see a map here on the left, which is showing those services via telehealth. On the right, we're going to show the number of services. And so you can just see the general variance across states and the variance across time. And then for the last few slides, we talked a little bit about those COVID-specific outcomes, just updating what we had in our previous deck. So at this point, more than a million Medicaid and CHIP beneficiaries under age 19 have received a test that was covered by Medicaid or CHIP for COVID-19 in 2020. Once again, you can see the variance here in the state map on the left, and you can see the actual count on the right. There were fewer than 130,000 beneficiaries treated for COVID-19 who were under age 19 in 2020. And once again, this is showing that treatment variance across states. And then similar to that general COVID information, here we're showing those hospitalizations. And we find that through the end of July, there were fewer than 2,100 of beneficiaries under age 19 who had been hospitalized for COVID-19. And here you can see that variation the same way we showed it in the beginning across inpatient stays, ICU stays, and ICU stays with ventilator use. So this slide on telehealth is also an update of our of a previous release. So we just updated everything with our more current data. And what you can see here is here we just explain what are we talking about, what are we measuring when we talk about services delivered via telehealth. And the key highlights here, which even though, you know, we continue to get more and more months of submissions, it really appears that telehealth utilization spiked in April. And then starting in May, it did start to decline through all age groups. So we find that the number of services delivered via telehealth appears to be highest among adults age 19 to 64, and that rates for children under 19 and adults over 65 are about the same. I do want to reemphasize that point in the beginning, particularly for beneficiaries age 65 and older who are probably duly eligible. You will only receive those claims covered by Medicaid and CHIP. So we do note that on all of the slides. And we do note that there is considerable variation across states in delivery via telehealth. So here you can see, looking at this chart over time, that there was a very large peak in April that does appear to be declining through July. You can see at the top that there were almost 47 million services delivered via telehealth just between March and July, which was just an explosion, almost 3,000% more compared to the prior year. And then on the left, you can just see that variance across states pegged to the per 100,000 beneficiaries. Here you can see it broken down across month and age, and you can just see, you know, that there does appear to be some variance in terms of different age groups. But those relationships tend to be pretty consistent over time. And then on these next few slides, we just basically break it out by age group. So you can really see the number. If you're more interested in a specific age group, it allows you to break it apart by under 19, 19 to 64, and then 65 and older. And then for this last section, we will spend a little more time here just because this is one of our new updates. So this presentation focuses on services for mental health and substance use disorders during the COVID-19 public health emergency. And we want to ground this in the background. So one of the reasons this is so important is because Medicaid is the largest payer for behavioral health services, including both mental health and sub-services in the United States. You know, so we are a major payer. You can see from the last bullet that a substantial portion of our beneficiaries have mental health disorders or receive sub-services. And, you know, we know that they face multiple barriers to care during, you know, regular times, not even during a pandemic. And so we think it's particularly important to examine what's happening in the face of the pandemic, especially given some of the trends that we had seen from our prior release related to children and mental health services. We also know, based on preliminary evidence, it appears that there has been a large increase in the number of adults reporting adverse mental health conditions. So, you know, I sort of alluded to in the prior slides that for children, there's been a decline in the number of services children are receiving, while simultaneously, at least in this case for adults, there appears to be an increase in potential mental health conditions. So we're sort of seeing, you know, I think the growing mental health crisis with a decline in services. So we really wanted to highlight that in these slides. Particularly also for substance use disorders, we have seen that preliminary evidence suggests there's an increase in drug-related mortality. So kind of going back to the same thing, you know, if there is an increase in drug abuse and drug-related mortality that is coinciding with a decline in service utilization, that could be a potential issue that we would want to look into further. And our preliminary results show the same thing across both topics that we sort of mentioned earlier for children, which is just that for both adults and kids, we are seeing that mental health services have dropped substantially. That began in April, and it has continued to decline through July in nearly all states. So there's a little bit less variance here than we see across some of the other topics. You know, there's a notable gap compared to prior year levels. It is very encouraging that services continue to be delivered via telehealth, but that increase is not enough to offset the decline in in-person services, especially because for some of these services, they just can't be delivered via telehealth. They require an inpatient or a partial inpatient setting. So, you know, it's very encouraging to see an increase in telehealth, but we know that that will not fully offset all the care that our beneficiaries need to receive. And this shows a similar slide for adults that we showed for children. So here what you're seeing is that outpatient mental health services for adults aged 19 to 64 started declining in March, and that decline has really appeared to continue through July. Telehealth did increase, but not enough to offset that decline. And so for adults, very similar to children, we see about almost 8 million fewer services, even when we account for that drastic increase in telehealth. And that is a 25% decline. So it's a very significant drop that appears to be persisting throughout the pandemic. And then this is just really showing that state variance, and I think, you know, this is getting back to that prior point, which is that even though there's lots of variation in terms of how quickly states submit their claims, we really see that states appear to have a general decline across both the faster submitters and the slower submitters. And this is showing you a very similar relationship for telehealth. So even though telehealth really exploded in March and April, it appears to have tapered or leveled off somewhat throughout the summer, it is not enough to offset the decline that we've seen in those outpatient services. And this shows that the slide for children, again, just to reorient it to this specific topic, you know, and just kind of highlighting the prior slide, it was about 8 million for adults 19 to 64. It's about 8 million for kids under 19. You know, that's over 16 million services. That is a lot of services, especially given the context in the beginning about what we're seeing from survey data and some preliminary substance use disorder data, that there is a growing need, but there is also simultaneously a growing gap in service utilization. And this shows the same thing for states here, that generally speaking, there was a decline that really hasn't started to rebound in most states, and this is one that is a little bit more consistent across states. And we're seeing the same thing here about telehealth. So I think, you know, the story is very similar across age groups for the most part, and across most topics, it seems that most states are, you know, tending to trend the same way. So if states are starting to rebound, while there is variance, many states will start to rebound. In this case, there is somewhat of an increase, but it is still very gradual and has not increased as much as we would want to see. And then this is just showing the same thing for SUD services. So we're seeing that SUD services for adults 19 to 64 declined in March, and they're still below those 2019 levels in July. And here we see that's about a 17% decline. We're almost 3 million services. So same thing, you know, we're in the millions of services. It is a substantial decline, particularly given what we're seeing surrounding drug-related mortality. And we're seeing the same thing here, that it appears to be fairly consistent in terms of what's happening in states where there was that decline that really has not started to rebound. There's always variance when we're looking at what's happening across states. But just generally speaking, we are not starting to see a very large increase in July back to pre-pandemic levels. Okay, so that was a quick overview of all of the slides that we recently released for COVID-19, including the two new presentations. And I definitely want to make sure to leave time for questions.
Thank you, Kim, for your presentation. So we're ready to take your questions now from the presenters that you heard today or any of your general questions. So let's begin by taking your questions through the chat function. I see we have several right now, and then we'll follow with taking questions over the phone line.
Okay, great. So the first question that's come in through the chat is for Kim on the data presentation, and it says, can you provide additional guidance on how we should interpret the maps on COVID-19 treatment and COVID-19 hospitalizations on slides 23 and 24? For example, if a state falls in the 2-3 category on the COVID-19 treatment map, how should we interpret that?
Yeah, so I will say that generally speaking, I think we've displayed this information for informative purposes about what's happening to Medicaid and CHIP as much as we possibly can. And in terms of a narrative around what to take away from the slides, we really leave that to the individual analytic project of, you know, the state or the researcher or the person of interest. So I think for us it's more about aggregating this, showing what's happening nationally and showing that there's variance. I mean, I think the most simple explanation for this type of slide in that variance is just some places appear to have more significant COVID-19 outbreaks than others. I think that's very consistent with what you would see from other data sets from HHS and in news reports, for example. So it appears that, you know, the pandemic, it is variable in terms of how it has impacted different states and different localities. And we would expect to see that variation reflected in our data. And I think it's a positive sign for in terms of, like, timeliness and accuracy that it appears to reflect other data sets that we've seen publicly released.
Okay, thanks. The next question is also for Kim on the data, and it says, do you think the decline in children's services is directly linked to school closures?
Yeah, so getting back to this one, I will say that we participated in a lot of meetings with stakeholders over the summer to talk about the foregone care, particularly for children. And I will say that in those meetings, the key stakeholders definitely expressed a lot of concern about the relationships between schools being closed and the services that kids receive. I will highlight, for example, on this slide for well child visits, you'll see here, for example, that between July and September, we normally see an explosion in the number of child screens that are probably related to kids getting seen before they start school, for example. So this is a time period that we, you know, really are interested in monitoring as data continues to come in, because we know that the services children receive are very heavily tied to school. We can't establish causality with this information. That's certainly a possible explanation. And we did a lot of meeting with stakeholders over the summer to see what we could do in the face of schools being closed. And I think it's also very encouraging to look at this slide on vaccinations, where we saw there was a lot of concern about this gap over the summer, and I think the stakeholders and states have done an absolutely great job of working to tie kids, you know, back into getting care and getting vaccines. So, you know, they're probably definitely related, but it absolutely seems like there are things that can be done that help close this gap, even in the face of school closures.
Okay, thanks. And the next question on the data presentation is a three-parter. How are mental health services defined? Do we use HEDIS definitions? And are services on the same day counted separately or as one visit?
So for the first one on mental health services, I could pull up the logic on that specifically. I think my contact information is in here, and we could send you the actual, you know, methodology that we use. But here we're looking at basically anything that is a service related to a mental health condition. So it is broadly defined. It's a cast a wide net. So I do not think that we're using the HEDIS definition. We're just using the administrative claims to look at mental health diagnoses and related procedures. In terms of that same day counting, I would have to dig into that a little bit further. Our goal is to look at distinct services, but I'd have to do a little bit more research on that one to make sure that I'm answering accurately.
Okay, thanks. And then we have a question that has come in for CAP related to our unwinding show that was released in January. And it says that the show letter states must repeat redeterminations after the PHE for individuals determined ineligible during the PHE if the beneficiary's initial redetermination is conducted more than 6 months prior to the scheduled termination date. Can you define repeat redetermination? Does that mean we have to schedule and send a new renewal form for these individuals?
Sure, this is Jessica. I can take that one. It is starting the process from the beginning. So in a case where you've identified that the individual during the public health emergency might potentially be ineligible, you would need to first attempt an ex parte renewal again, or a renewal based on available information, based on updated data sources at that point. And if based on updated information at that point you find that the individual, you don't have sufficient information to redetermine the individual's eligibility, you would then send another renewal form. So in effect, it is conducting the full renewal process at the end of the period that we're referring to.
Okay. Thank you, Jessica.
Shall we check the phone lines, operator, to see if we have any questions there?
Of course. If you'd like to register a question, please press the 1 followed by the 4. And I'm showing no questions at this time.
Thank you. Judith, would you like to wait a few minutes to see if we receive additional questions, or would you like to close at this point?
Yeah, let's give everybody just 30 more seconds in case anybody's scrambling in as a slow typist like I am trying to get a question in, and then we'll close it out.
Sure. Again, you can submit your questions through the chat line, or we have the phone lines open if you'd like to submit a question that way.
All right, last look. Anything in the chat box?
It looks like we just got one more that came in for Kim on the data presentation. It says, can you also share how you are identifying ICU and ICU with ventilator services?
Yeah, sure. So for that one, I'm working to pull up the methodology on it now. Basically, it's the same thing for all of these. We're just using either the claim type and the settings with procedure codes and diagnostic codes to identify all of this. So we do, I believe in our fact sheet that corresponds with this, we talk specifically about, for example, how we're identifying COVID, how we're identifying all these treatments. And so that's just that more detailed methodological underpinning so that you could absolutely understand exactly what you're looking at. So that is available with the fact sheet online for this release, or you can always contact us and we can send you that more detailed methodology.
Thanks. So we'll check the phone lines one additional time. Operator?
And as a reminder, to register for your question, please press the 1 followed by the 4. And we have no questions.
Thank you. Judith, I'll turn to you.
Thanks, Jackie. I'll say that's a wrap. So thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. I really want to especially thank all of our presenters for their really informative presentations and excellent information. Looking forward, we will meet you again soon. The topic and the invitation for our next call will be forthcoming, and certainly if any questions come up between these calls, feel free to reach out to us, to your state leads, or bring the questions to our next call. Thanks again for joining us today, and have a good rest of your day.
That does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation and ask that you please disconnect your lines.